You're listening to the Strongpreneur Podcast, where we're waging war on mediocrity. Live your strong life and build your strong business with me, Tom Reber. Mediocrity dies today.
Thank you for tuning in to the Strongpreneur Podcast, where we are waging war on mediocrity in your life and in your business. I'm Tom Rebert, and today I'm excited to have my guest Mike Michalowicz on with us. Mike is the entrepreneur behind three multi-million dollar companies and is the author of Profit First, The Pumpkin Plan, and what Business Week deemed the entrepreneur's cult classic, The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur. Mike is a former small business columnist for the Wall Street Journal and regularly travels the globe as an entrepreneurial advocate. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom, for having me on the show.
So check it out. I'm reading the quick facts that you sent over me about you. And okay. This is great.
He's shockingly handsome. Quick fact number one.
I did notice that, and I hid the picture from my wife.
Women go crazy over him. Fact number two.
the only thing that makes it sexier is if you wore a half shirt. So,
I was all over the half shirt in the 80s. All over that.
But did you have a mesh half shirt?
Yeah, I will not admit or deny.
All right, there you go. So I'm reading this, and it says you launched three multi-million dollar companies before your 35th birthday. You were the Small Business Association's Young Entrepreneur of the Year when you were 26. You sold your first company to a private equity firm, your second to a Fortune 500 company. You've written three books. You wrote for the Wall Street Journal. Your books have been translated into 10 languages. And I read that, and I went, well, I bet he... I was looking at my own life, at what I did, and I actually officiated a Nigerian baby naming ceremony once.
What?
So there you go. Top that.
I can't. B, as you read mine, I sound like a self-effacing tool, and I sound like I have a huge ego. You know, what I got put in those facts are like, that literally is all the monumental peak moments of my life, mm-hmm. but 99% of it has been struggle, disgustingness, ugliness, and I have nothing like a Nigerian baby name.
So throw about 75 people into a two-bedroom apartment, and at the time, my wife and I were working in campus ministry up at the University of Wisconsin, and we're Badgers, and I was invited by a family that went to our church to officiate their baby naming ceremony.
That's cool.
And so it was crazy. You got like 75 people or whatever it was crammed in a two-bedroom apartment in August. And I'm like, the baby's name is whatever it was.
Whatever it was. That's the monumental moment. What was it?
I don't remember it. I'm sorry.
What? This is the whole ceremony.
So here's what I didn't realize. I didn't realize at the point, or at that moment 20 years ago, how cool of a moment that would have been.
Yeah.
And it was a name I really couldn't pronounce, and shame on me for not remembering. But all I remember is everyone was really formal and polite and quiet. And the minute I named the kid, the music cranked on, the food came out, you got 75 people dancing for 4 hours in a two-bedroom apartment in August in Wisconsin. So it was crazy.
So now, did they say, like, the name could be, like, Cecil Baum or Kamali or something, and you're like, let's call him Mike. Do you pick the name?
I had no power over the name. So it was, I just read the piece of paper they gave me, and I said a prayer, and we were done. So it was good.
That is cool, man.
So yeah, it was a cool moment. So listen, you talked about all the fluff here in the beginning, and I don't mean fluff in a light way, but like you said, the peaks.
Yeah. It's
And one of the reasons, well, really the biggest reason I invited you to be part of this podcast is it's really this simple. Most small business owners are getting their butts kicked.
Yeah.
You've had your butt kicked a lot, and I know that from reading your book.
Yeah.
Then you had this moment of change, and now you're helping thousands of people not get their butts kicked so much anymore. And so I just thought it made sense to have you on, and I'd love if you could just share a couple minutes of your story and maybe the whooping you took and how you turned things around.
Yeah. So I love to help people that have had their asses handed to them. Mm-hmm. And it's because I have had my ass handed to me multiple times, and quite frankly, deservedly so. The thing you didn't highlight there is, yes, I've built and sold companies. after selling my second business, I my ego took over because I'd achieved wealth in my early 30s that I never thought I'd experience in my life. And I presumed that to be wealthy, it was important to live the wealthy lifestyle, the stuff you see in the magazines, to show off to my friends, to own all the cars and live in the expensive town and join the club. And so I did all that stuff. And the more I spent on like those effects and stuff, I realized that like no one really cared or noticed. So mm-hmm. I assumed I needed to show off more, and my ego just got bigger and bigger. And I was I can't think of a better word, but I was a dick.
Yeah.
Not that I was rude to people. Well, maybe I was. I didn't think I was, but I do remember in my mind, if you and I met and you told me you had a business, in my mind, I was saying, well, I don't care what Tom's about to say because I'm better. Like I really thought I was better than other people. And I'm not necessarily the most religious guy, but I do believe there's something far greater going on. And I believed it was my turn for a lesson. I lost everything. And in very short order, it took me about 2 years. Every penny I had made in selling my businesses was gone. And the moment I wrote about this in my book, I came home, happened to be Valentine's Day, was the day I realized I was on the verge of bankruptcy. And I told my family, because I hadn't been telling them up to this point, I was too ashamed. And I gathered my family, my wife, my three children. My daughter, then 8 years old, ran out of the room. And as she ran out, Tom, I was like, that's the answer, run away. Like, I got to just run away from my problems. She got it, right? Because, she was terrified. Well, she ran back in with a piggy bank, and she put it down in front of me, and she goes, Daddy, I'm gonna make it work for us, or something like that.
Oh, man, help. Break yeah. your heart.
Oh, my God.
How old was she?
8 years old.
Okay.
And it was so humbling, and so full of shame. And so it was so many emotions at the same time. I was blown away that my daughter would ever even think this way, and how selfless she was, and how selfful or selfish I was. And I also endeavored, though, at that point, I knew that there had to be a new me, and I had to go through, like, I guess, a renaissance for myself. And it was about 2 years. I went through a period of depression, functional depression, and kept working, but just removed myself from any social settings and just really struggled in life, but endeavored to find a better way. And as I did, to document it. And that's what I did. I became an author. Every book I've written, I now realize, I didn't actually even realize at the point, but I've really written as a therapy for myself, to answer questions I've had for myself, to really educate myself, which, it's kind of a weird epiphany. I mean, every book I'm writing, really, I thought it was to serve others, but I've come to realize it's self-serving.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that being the therapy, because I can usually, you know, I do a lot of writing and blogging, and if you want to really know what's going on in my life and in my head, it's usually what I'm blogging about. You know, if I'm talking about being more organized in your business or something, it's usually because I'm dealing with it myself. And in a lot of ways, it is my therapy. It's almost my way of, you know, smacking myself upside the head and telling myself to wake up and get control of things. And so I think you're dead on with that it definitely becomes sort of a therapy to help you move on. And
that's what it is. It's a therapy. And now my philosophy is anyone that is in a position of teaching, and that doesn't necessarily mean just teachers, like professors and stuff, but someone that's an author or someone that's a mentor or someone that's a parent, inevitably the lesson we're teaching, I really have come to believe, is the lesson we're looking to learn. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. So your daughter comes in with the piggy bank. It starts this 2-year journey or so. How have you changed? Like, what would you say are the top couple ways that experience really changed you?
I think my ego, I hope my ego has been permanently ripped out. I watch those movies like The Exorcist or something crazy like that. Mm-hmm. And I think I have my own version of that I was so resistant and fighting to keep that disgustingness inside me. And I had to go through that experience. And when I hit rock bottom, a lot of people say, you know, when you hit rock bottom, the only way it goes up, I found out that's a lie. When you hit rock bottom, there's you can actually get dragged along the bottom, and there's shards of glass and jagged rocks down there, and stay down there as long as necessary until something changes. So I think one of the biggest changes is I got my ego checked and hopefully checked permanently and never comes back. I think I've also come to realize that in business, that's my passion is business and entrepreneurship, that I always thought size mattered. Mm-hmm. And I realized it didn't. That health is what matters. How healthy is our business? And I always thought, you know, if I had a 30 person company, that's a good healthy company, and maybe I should get up to 40 or 50 really to show my success, maybe get 100 employees mm-hmm. there. But now I realize, no, it's just about running efficiently. And today my business literally is three of us here, mm-hmm. and it's healthier than any of my past businesses have been, and there's more comfort in that than ever. So maybe not necessarily that small's better, but I do know that healthy is better. So that's a big lesson that's now sticking with me.
Yeah, that's, you know, you talk about building a bigger business. Did you find that at that time you were so into comparisons?
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Yeah,
So it was a total chest pound fest for me. It's funny, I was talking to someone recently. I remember going to my first business meeting. There's this group called Entrepreneurs Organization, which, by the way, is an amazing organization. Still exists today. I'm still a member of it. There's about 10,000 members internationally. And I remember walking into the first meeting, and the conversations as I met other entrepreneurs was very quickly, what do you do? And really, how big is your business? Mm. And the question wasn't like that direct. It was usually like, oh, how many employees do you have? What's your numbers look like? What's the run rate? Any big clients? Who are your clients? And very quickly, it was chest pounding, and I felt compelled to show how successful I was. And I lied. I mean, people say, how big is your business? Like, oh, we're just past the $2 million mark, when we were really doing, we're barely doing a million, right. You know? Yep. But in my head, it wasn't a lie. I justified it by making up some phony numbers. And I was just caught in that game of grow at all costs. And that's a very dangerous game, because usually the cost is the bottom line. Usually the cost is your stress and your health. It's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it's at some point you have to step back and go, you know, how am I personally going to define my own success and my own happiness and not compare to others? Because when you're comparing to others, there's always somebody bigger and better. Always somebody who makes more money, does more revenue. I talk a lot with people about, you know, the only business that really matters here is yours. And, you know, what does a win look like for you when this thing's cranking along the way you want it to?
Yeah.
And not being caught up. So, did you find, or do you find that entrepreneurs tie their own worth to the business?
Yeah. Yeah. And I still do. I've yet to disconnect from it. You know, okay. A lot of people say, a business is like raising a child, right? Like, you're the parent and it's a child, and it goes through its infancy, or you got to nurture it and then becomes an adolescent. I call bull on that. I don't think it's a parent-child relationship. I think we're Siamese twins, and that our vital organs are connected and our soul is shared. So when my business struggles, when business isn't going well, I feel it. Yeah. I don't feel well. I feel I'm the problem. When things are tearing along in business, life feels great. I'm not at the level where I'm disconnected with it, I don't put my value in it, at least. I mean, if my business is hurting, I'm hurting. There's no question about
sure.
that.
Sure.
But as my business grows, I don't think I'm a better person anymore. That's at least one level of maturity I finally have achieved, I hope.
That's awesome. That's tough to do.
Oh, man.
Because it is our baby. So every business owner knows deep down they should be making a profit.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a given, right? We all know.
The whole reason we're in business.
Yeah, we need to make a profit.
Yeah, you need to sustain.
Why do so many don't or not make a profit?
So because there's an axiom. And so what axioms are beliefs that are so established that it is the tendency of us just to believe them because they've been around forever. It's best explained by example. The world is flat. right? That was an axiom for the longest period of time. Literally, and we all know this, there was a period in human history when people said, yeah, the world's flat, and if you go too far out on the edge, you're going to fall off.
Yep.
And therefore, people wouldn't take their boats out in the water. And the next person growing up didn't say, hey, you sure the world's flat? They just said, well, everyone says the world's flat, so clearly the world's flat. So people believed it. Well, one day someone challenged it. It was the Greek philosophers who started challenging this belief, and enough momentum finally occurred when people said, whoa, maybe the world isn't flat. So those beliefs exist in business, and their axioms are all over the place, but in business, there's an axiom around growth. Hmm. And the belief is this: profit occurs via growth. You have to grow to be successful. You are only one client away, or one big investor away, or one good move away from becoming profitable. So what happens is people say, well, don't worry about the profit, worry about the growth, because the residual benefit will be profit. Don't worry about the profit, worry about getting land that next big client, because when that happens, the profit will trigger.
Yeah, because growth fixes everything.
That's what we believe, and that's the axiom. Yep. And I'm calling total bullshit on that. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. It is a world is flat lie. And here's why. There is a behavioral theorem. It's called Parkinson's Law. It explains human consumption behavior. And what I mean by this is human tendency to increase our consumption of something based upon supply. If you and I went out to watch a football game and I brought a six pack, mm-hmm. chances are you and I would knock off a six pack. If I brought a 12 pack, chances are we'll knock off the 12 pack. The more supply is there, our behavior adjusts to consume more of it.
Right.
Well, this is true for beer. It's true for lots of things, but it's also true for money. And so what happens in our businesses, when we do land that next client, because growth is everything, money comes in, our natural tendency, there's more supply now, is to expand our demand for that supply, or expand our demand for money. Mm-hmm. We actually start spending more. So if you look at your business, it's normal human behavior. As sales increase, that expenses, you'll notice, increase at almost the identical rate. It's called Parkinson's Law. So
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, growth is, all I want to say is growth is a trap. The more you grow, it will not bring about profitability. It's natural human behavior for growth to result in more expenses.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I saw that, another life ago when I owned a residential painting company. Mm-hmm. And before I started paying attention to holding our crews accountable with man hours and things like that, we would just go, hey, paint the room. And they'd take a day to paint the room. Well, then we woke up, we said, you know what, we should probably tell them how long to take to paint the room. And we said, paint the room in 4 hours. And that same room that took all day got done in 4 hours. You know, because, you know, what I found is, you know, the work will always expand to the time made available.
Always, always. You know, I got a little trick, and I do this myself, and it's real simple. When I hire employees, I pay extra deferential preference toward part-time employees, because when you give someone, it's the exact same thing you just said, 4 hours, you say, yeah, I get this day's work done, and by the way, you're a part-time employee, you got 4 hours, they get it done. And I'm not saying it's full-time employees are bad. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying, if the same level of work given to a part-time employee or a full-time employee, it will take them their entire time to get the stuff done. It's
absolutely
just human nature.
Yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. Talk about a little bit about how profit first works, just in not in theory, because I know it works, but in theory.
Yeah. Yeah. So the theorem is this, that most businesses, while we're told you got to have income statements and you got to tie that into your cash flow and balance statement, understand all these different metrics, most of us just look at our bank balance. I call it bank balance accounting. Most business owners that I know, and I surely do this, I log into my bank account every so often, see how much money's in there, and based upon the balance I see, I make decisions on my business. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the problem. The more money that's in there, remember, we just talked about this, the more likely I'm to spend that money. It's Parkinson's Law. So when there's a lot of money in there, I justify expenses. When there's no money, I go into sales mode or collections mode. So what I explain in Profit First is we have to leverage this natural behavior of Parkinson's Law. When money comes in, instead of having that one account, Instead, set up an account specifically for profit, and also set up accounts for other purposes too. I explain those in the book. But basically, if say a $1,000 deposit comes in, immediately transfer a predetermined percentage to your profit account, maybe 10%. So $100 goes there. Allocate other money for other purposes, your tax responsibilities, your own personal regular income. And then the remaining amount, which now may only be 50 or 40 or even 30% of that first chunk, is available for expenses. So when $1,000 comes in, you don't have $1,000, you have $300. Mm. And simply by breaking into multiple accounts, this is grandma's old envelope system, by breaking into multiple accounts, you see what money is available for what purpose, and that simple little adjustment, our behavior starts to change.
I can't do that, Mike. It can't be done.
Can't be done.
We have bills to pay, and I have employees to pay. I mean, you've heard people say that, right?
Oh my God!
So other than smack them when they say that,
yeah.
What do you tell them?
Yeah. So I say, well, where do you stand in your business? Inevitably, the response is, I'm barely getting by now, Mike. Mm-hmm. I'm check by check, and I say, realize you've already, just by saying that, you've proved Parkinson's law. The money made available to you, you found a way to consume it and justify the expenses in its entirety. What I'm telling you is we're going to give you less money, and you will continue to do that behavior of finding a way to justify and spend up to the limit that is made available to you. So you've already proven it out. You just got to take this step. And I still get resistance because ultimately theory and execution is two different things. So I tell people, just get started. Set up a profit account and do 1%. A $1,000 deposit, 1% is $10. All right, will you miss $10?
Not at all.
Nah, I can do that. Nope. If you start with just 1% to your profit account, do that for a few months, you're not going to get rich that way, but you will get confident. You will start seeing it's working, and then you can start ramping those numbers up and start getting rich.
And you're building the routine.
You're building the new habit. You're putting guardrails around something you already do, checking your bank balance every day, and leveraging it now to build some profits.
So let's say you and I were talking before the call here today, or the interview, and I mentioned that years ago I ran a painting business and all this other stuff. And so we'd have $10,000 coming in for a project. And I had employees or subcontractors and materials to buy and cost of goods sold directly related to the job. And say it was $5,000. So now I got $5,000 left. Is that the amount I'm pulling my owner's profit out of, or am I pulling it out of that top line income?
Oh, great question. Yeah. So in a case where your business has a high degree of subcontractors and materials, if you manufacture, you have a lot of materials. If you are a paint contractor, like you were, you probably have a lot of subs. In that case, you subtract that out. To explain a number in my book, I call it real revenue. It's basically the same as gross profit, but the reason I gave it a different term is I need entrepreneurs to understand what revenue you're really making.
Yeah,
I met a guy, he's in the construction industry, does $50 million in revenue, and he says, I got a $50 million company. I said, how much do you spend in materials and subcontractors? He's like, well, we sub out almost everything. We spend about $30 million on subcontractors and another $10 million on the building materials. So I said, you don't have a $50 million company. You have a $10 million company
that's
managing another $40 million of transactions above the line. And I said, you got to realize this, because the important thing is you're trying to behave like the $50 million guy when you're ready, really a $10 million guy.
Right.
And he's like, So your business, say you were doing 2 million, but you had all these subs and stuff, and it was say 1.5 million, you only have a $500,000 business.
Yep.
And by the way, this is, some people are like, when they're in the growth mentality and size matters, they get really defensive and say, no, I got a $50 million company. No, I'm at a $2 million company. When you have this realization, it's a slap in the face to say, okay, start behaving much more frugally, much smaller, much tighter. And this realization can help a lot of people run the business the way it needs to be run.
Yeah, I think that term you use in the book is amazing, the real income, the real revenue.
Real revenue.
Because this is really what you have to operate the business off of now.
After you
produce your widget, whatever it is, this is what's left, and this is what you pay yourself with, give your profit, your profit and any overhead and things like that. Profit's a funny thing. I hear all the time, or a lot of times, I just want to be fair to my customers.
Sure.
I hear that all the time, and I talk about, I said, guys, you making a profit in your business, in a lot of ways, is the financial pat on the back for doing a good job.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I have a little additional spin to that. When people say I want to be fair to my customers, I say, is it fair to never serve them again? And they say, or to abandon them? Would that be fair? And they're like, well, of course I wouldn't do that. I say, well, when you're out of business, you will. And you have to run profitable and you have to run sustainably so that you can stick around and serve them just as well. So I agree, it's a pat on the back. But it's also your responsibility to be fairly compensated and appropriately compensated so you can continue to deliver the exceptional service and products that you do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not, if your needs aren't being made as the business or met as the business owner, you know, your salary and your profit and your taxes and things like that, you're never going to be fully, you're not going to be strong enough personally to do the work you need to do in the business to support your employees and your clients.
Yeah, and
you're too stressed out.
It's the ultimate martyr syndrome, and I've been there. I live that. It's like, oh, you know, I got to sacrifice myself to serve others, and you weaken yourself, and you weaken yourself, and inevitably, your service is compromised, your energy's not there, you're not surviving, so you're panicked all the time, your focus is elsewhere. And I've seen it when it comes to profitability and what we offer. I've seen with employees, I know, and personally have experienced, where I had a couple employees that I couldn't afford to keep on board. They weren't performing well. They weren't even really well suited for the business. But since I hired them, I felt obligated to keep them for life.
Yeah.
And I was compromising all 10 of my employees by trying to keep on two folks that I shouldn't anymore. Meaning I could barely keep this business afloat and was on the verge of upending the entire company killing off 10 jobs just to salvage two.
Just to salvage two, yeah. So let me ask you this. You know, I'm sure there's people listening right now that go, all right, I need to make some more money like right now, like yesterday. How do they find more money in their business right now? I mean, are there some tips you can give them just to, you know, even if they don't bring any more money in right now, you know, what are some things that they could capture some more profit with?
Yeah, so the thing you can do immediately is sort out your customers. Every company, my company too, has exceptional customers and then everyone else. And we've been told by our mom, you know, treat everyone equally, treat everyone fairly, everyone the same. And mom lied. Like, we have to actually treat our best customers really, really exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm.
Best customers are defined by this. People that spend the most money with you, ideally buy from you recurringly, and you love doing business with. Inevitably, those folks have more in their purse. They love you already. They're showing through their actions of buying from you, and you like them. If you sort your customers out and identify who your best are, immediately go to your best and say, what else can I do to serve you even better? Is there anything else you need? You'll be surprised. There's often opportunity there and it brings immediate revenue. But the second thing you learn too is your worst customers inevitably are costing you money to keep them. Some customers, say you have a customer that gave you, I don't know, just for easy numbers, $100 for a service you provided. If that was your top customer, maybe you got the service done in an hour. So 1 hour results in $100.
Mm-hmm.
Your worst customer says, you spend an hour, they say, you know, the results weren't what I expected, do it again. 2 hours. You know what? Not there. 3 hours. Now they say, you know what? Done. Not happy. Not paying you. So now you spent 3 hours and got zero.
Right.
And that happens. Those bad customers, this is the courageous step. You have to get rid of them. You have to get rid of that lower 5 or 10% of customers immediately. Because what that will free up is, first of all, your time.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, the emotional weight that bad customers have, you fall asleep thinking about them, you wake up thinking about them, gets alleviated. That little bit of extra time you gain back, you can now refocus that time on your best customers who have the money and desire to use you. It immediately will give you great returns. That's how you do it.
I love that tip. I remember, I think it was back in 2005 or six, I sent a fax out on a Friday afternoon and I fired some clients.
Yeah,
that a couple clients that were about $500,000 a year to me.
Yeah,
and I was freaking out. I was absolutely freaking out. My business partner and I were looking at each other, standing at the fax machine when we used a fax machine. And I said, "Are you sure I'm sending this?" And he's like, "Yeah." And I'd go to send it, and like right before I hit start send, he'd be like, "Okay, are we sure we want to do this?"
Yeah.
And so we did. And our phone blew up almost immediately.
Mm.
And it was a couple days of just pure hell.
Mm.
And within a month, we were making $20,000 more a month.
Oh,
it was the greatest thing that ever happened. It was like, you know, blue skies and rainbows, you know. So,
it's so true. And you're this happens over and over again. I've actually yet to find a single instance where a company fired its worst clients and it didn't return. It didn't bring an immediate return, usually an immediate financial return, but in every case, an immediate return of relief.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost every time. I mean, it's,
yeah.
So I had a method of raising profit immediately in my business years ago. God's truth here. I would walk into a project, I'd do a bid, and at the time I think we were bringing about, say, a 10% net profit at the end of the day.
Right.
And I would come up with a price and say it was $5,000. I would go, okay, this project's $5,000. Am I willing to do it for $500?
Okay.
Because that's really what we were making at the end of the day.
Oh, there you go.
I called it the hell no method. And so I would look at that and I'd be like, am I willing to take the risk of this project on? And at the time we were in the construction trade, so there's a lot of physical risk and, you know, peripheral damage that you could do to properties and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we really looked to weigh that risk, and it actually got us to raise our prices several times and take on the right projects. So
is cool.
Yeah,
you know, there's a huge opportunity in raising money. I found the biggest detractor, the person that argues the most with us about a price increase, is ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get past ourselves, I'm often surprised, and you, I think you'll be surprised too, is when you raise prices to your customers, some customers will say, I appreciate how long I was getting by on the cheap. I'm shocked you didn't do this sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Some will say nothing. Actually, the vast majority will say nothing. A few will leave you. And the few that leave are the price shoppers. And who wants to deal with price shoppers in the
exactly.
first place?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like I've never not had a win by increasing my prices.
Yeah. Seems like the smart thing to do then. Raise your prices, everybody.
Raise your prices. And by the way, when you raise your prices, you'll go through this exercise. In your head, you'll say, oh, I can't raise my prices. And you say, well, I'm going to raise my prices. Then you say, well, if I raise my prices, I have to justify it. And then you'll have the conversation of, how do I bring validity to this price point? Mm-hmm. What do I have to do that justifies this price point? And then you'll find, maybe you're already doing some things, and maybe you'll find some others, but you'll find ways to support it. So very quickly, you'll find how you can justify it in your own head, too.
Yeah, you know, you've got to be... You know, if you want to have the highest prices in your industry and make those profits and things like that, you got to add the most value. You got to make the experience the best for the client. And that, you know, I found that that's one of the things that justifies me being a higher priced provider of my services. Is doing that. So earlier, you talked a little bit about depression.
Yeah.
A couple of years. Not to go way in the past here, but
no. Let's enjoy ourselves.
So, speaking of, did you hear me whisper yelling at my son a couple minutes ago?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So I put signs on all the entrance points to the house.
Yeah.
Be quiet, I'm recording.
And that's a sign.
The door,
speak up and knock on the door.
Yeah. So anyway, I need to go choke people when I'm off. So several years ago, I got kicked in the face and woke up several hours later. Okay. Mm-hmm. My friends and I, this is actually before I joined the Marine Corps, we went over the border of the next state because, you know, we thought it'd be a good idea to go meet the local girls over there.
Sure.
And the local guys didn't like the fact that we were there trying to find the local girls. So I got kicked in the face, woke up several hours later.
So literally kicked in the face.
Yeah, the last thing I saw was a number 11 on the bottom of a boot.
Ooh, that's a good size foot hitting you.
Yeah. And it sucked. And so entrepreneurs, strong entrepreneurs, typically take quite a beating, right? You know, we can take it over and over and over. We keep getting up and running into the same wall. But after a while, you get to a point where you start going dark mentally and you've just had enough. And I know you shared a little bit about a time that you went in the tank, so to speak, had some functional depression.
Yeah.
How did you motor through that head trash? How did you, how'd you get through that? What were some things that you did that I know will help other people listening, because it's pretty common with business owners?
Yeah, I that's a good question. You know what I think I really did was first I owned up to it. Maybe that was it. I was in denial. I'm like, oh, it's just, you know, I'm in a bad mood. I'm just not, it's just me. Maybe I'm a little bit under the weather. Maybe it's a stressful time of year. So at first I was doing all these excuses, but that gnawing feeling wasn't going away. And maybe it was the moment when I admitted to myself, I'm like, you know, I'm just not okay. I'm ashamed of what has happened and what I've caused to myself, and this is the state I'm in. When I just kind of accepted this mm-hmm. is the state I'm in, at least I knew I was at rock bottom. Once I did that, I remember very distinctly, I was talking to my friend, his name is Joe Spano. I was talking with Joe and just telling him, I've been down now for like 6 months or whatever, or a year, and I think I'm experiencing depression. He said, oh, how's your journaling going? I'm like, what do you mean journaling? He's like, you know, writing a diary. I'm like, diary? That is so sissy. I'm like, okay. He goes, Mike, trust me. Start writing a journal. He's like, you know, he goes, never use the word diary, by the way. He's like, I was just kidding with you.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. I start journaling, and I'm like, what's the benefit? I'm like, is this so I can kind of track and like talk to a doctor? I mean, he goes, no. He goes, there's thoughts going through your mind so fast and so furious that you can't even listen to anymore. Just write down whatever comes to mind. It's your outlet. So I started journaling, and I wrote down stuff that's so vile and angry and aggressive at God, at the world, at myself, at everything.
Yeah.
That theirs was the therapy. Just let it out. I've never read it again. I still have it. It's actually sitting on my desk right now. I'm touching it right now. But whenever I feel lost or something, I go to this. That started the recovery. That started the turning point, because while I didn't have the solution, I now had the outlet. So first was acknowledging it to myself. I was like, okay, this is what I'm experiencing. Second was finding an outlet, and was this journaling. And I started to climb out. Now, and climb out is not straight up. It's up and down, down even further, scrape your face on the bottom again, back up, down. It was kind of a bumpy ride. And it took me about 2 years. But the last kind of step that really kind of opened me up was finding a life's purpose. Mm-hmm. And I have absolute clarity about that now. It's come about. As I was writing my first book, it became very clear what my life's purpose is. And this may be God-defined, maybe self-defined. It's too beyond me to comprehend, mm-hmm. but I have a life's purpose. And that belief and clarity has helped me get out of depression and functional depression completely, but it's helped me navigate so many tough times and hiccups that I've experienced that could have thrown me back into a little bit of a tailspin. Just by having purpose, I say, oh, bump in the road, testing my willpower, get back on purpose. And it's not all rose-colored glasses now, things are really moving forward in one direction because I have that purpose.
That's great. Would you mind sharing a little bit of what that purpose is?
Yeah, sure. So my life's purpose is to guide entrepreneurs to express their authentic self, their true self, via their businesses. That's my purpose. And kind of like we were talking about earlier, as I'm out endeavoring to help people use entrepreneurship as a platform to express themselves, I've come to realize this is a lesson I'm trying to teach myself.
Yeah,
I need to learn this for myself. And that's my life's purpose, is to free people into being really comfortable in their own skin via a business platform.
I love it. I love it because I think, anytime you turn the news on and you see something about profits and corporations and businesses, it's always negative. You know, it's like, oh, this big company, all they care about is profit. And what I find is more people like you that I talk to, you guys are, you're in this for way different reasons. You're truly looking to, you know, serve people, make their lives better, make their lives easier using, you know, the gifts and talents and, you know, beatings you've taken through the years to help them with that. So at this point in the game,
yeah,
are you is there anything that you're that you're afraid of, or are there any fears you deal with as an entrepreneur now?
I was going to say, oh, yeah, there's a lot of fears. Like, I'm afraid of heights. I hate heights, but that doesn't really count for entrepreneurship. So it's funny, just going with the heights, I'm afraid of heights, so I actually throw myself into scenarios where I got to challenge it, and I've become more in control of myself. I mean, I used to get shaky legs. Yeah. So I just did, like, this 600-foot zip line. I mean, you're literally 600 feet in the air. It's a mountain-to-mountain zip line. And it was terrifying, but once it was accomplished, I was like, oh, now I can go up 10 floors and it doesn't bug me. Is there stuff I'm afraid of in entrepreneurship? Yeah, I'm afraid of failure. I'm afraid when my best client says, I don't want to do business with you anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid when our credit card processor puts us on hold because they thought there was a fraudulent transaction went through that didn't happen. So when people say they're not afraid of anything, maybe. I don't have that talent.
Right.
I'm afraid all the time, but I'm not out of control. So fear can invoke panic. It can cause sporadic reaction, mm-hmm. or fear can be channeled to have a much more controlled but energized response. And I think I've gotten to the point where, not in all circumstances, but in many circumstances where there's a fear trigger, it brings me a burst of energy, and I hope I have the maturity to consistently channel it now so it's productive and not just a sporadic kind of shooting guns up in the air type thing.
Yeah, you know, I call it walking into the punch. If you and I are standing face to face and you're going to haul off and hit me in the face,
yeah,
it's going to hurt a lot. But the minute I see you rear back to punch me, if I close the distance,
right, sure,
your punch will never reach full strength, yeah. And it'll hurt less. And I found that time and time again with just things I fear. So real quick, I thought for many years that I was stupid. I actually spent a couple years in grade school riding the short yellow bus to school.
Mm.
Okay, and big long story for that we won't go into, that I don't even know I fully understand, but whatever it did is it set me on this course where I just didn't think I was smart. So I didn't try in school, I was insecure, yeah, about things like that. And there was an event years ago that that I had to go to, or I'd been invited to over and over again to speak, and I didn't go because it was an education industry event.
Oh,
and I was terrified of it. And finally, I'm like, you know, dude, you got to go toe-to-toe with this. You know, it's never going to get any better. And so I went and I spoke and I realized that I wasn't stupid. I mean, it was like, you know, this hallelujah moment for me. It sounds ridiculous, but
no.
I want to encourage people that, you know, if you're afraid to, you know, implement some of this stuff with making profit a priority in your business, if you're afraid of making those phone calls and, you know, telling your bookkeeper that, hey, this is how we're doing things from now on, if you're afraid of letting people go, you're afraid of whatever's going to make you stronger in the end, you've got to go toe-to-toe with those things.
You know what's funny is it requires us to do a courageous thing, and what it is admitting that we're wrong. So you labeled yourself as stupid, mm-hmm. but the courageous thing is then to say, I was wrong with that label. That's scary.
Right.
That's scary to say everything I believed was wrong. I have a similar story, but not, I mean, similar in a very goofy way, because it's not nearly on any scale what you just shared. I really believed that French toast makes me vomit. Because I was like, I think I was like in third grade, I was like maybe 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10 years old. My mom served French toast. I ate some and I threw up.
You threw up, right?
Yeah.
And I did the same thing with popcorn.
Cause and effect, right? So popcorn makes you puke. And so until like I was in college, I would never eat French toast. And I remember one day at the cafeteria, all they had left was French toast. I was so hungry. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't eat this, but I have to eat. And there's this whole dilemma. I'm like 19 years old, tears are coming down. Like, I'm going to be puking. I put as much syrup as I could find on there. It was just buried in syrup. And I took one bite. I'm like, damn, this is pretty delicious. I take another bite. Like 10 bites in, I'm like, this is, and like, I'm not even nauseous. And then I unwound that whole belief. And then I had to take the embarrassing admission that, holy crap, what I had defined for myself is mm-hmm. wrong. And that's true when it comes to being stupid or to being unsuccessful or believing that entrepreneurship requires excruciating hard work or whatever labels or beliefs we assign changing them is so hard because we have to admit that it was wrong to ever sign that in the first place.
Yeah. Well, that's good stuff, man. And I will, you know, we get together in person sometime. I will eat popcorn in front of you if you eat French toast in front of me. And I think we'll
only if there's a 6-pack of beer.
Six pack of beer, and we're good. You know, yeah. If we put a 12-pack there, we could drink it. It would happen. So
we put a case, it'd be dangerous. Yeah. We could do it.
So, as we kind of wrap this up today, where are you headed next? What's going on?
So I'm on the brink of kind of a next level thing that is still confidential because there is a contract as I like to say, as thick as my skull, which means it's very thick, in place, and I'm about a month out from the decision. Either it's going to be a go or no go. All arrows point to a go, and if it goes, my mission to, you know, show people, to guide people expressing their authentic self via business, is just going to go to a whole nother level. That's what's on the border, and I'm almost giddy with anticipation, and at the same time I can't say anything about it because of what the contract is.
That's all good. I get it. So
yeah. So that's on the brink for me.
Well, we wish you a ton of luck with that.
Thank you.
Listen, Mike, I appreciate you taking time with us today to share a bit about your story and all the time that you spent. Listen, everybody, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy of Profit First, and that's on Amazon, right?
Yeah, Profit First is on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. It's even on my website, MikeMcAllowitz.com.
There you go. And go and check out the Profit First podcast. You guys are hilarious on there. within like 30 seconds, if you're not laughing, then you're just a crabby McSnappy Pants or something. I don't know what you are, but I put the earbuds in and I'm literally laughing in 30 seconds every time I listen to that podcast. There's some great stuff to help you build a stronger business there. Mike, if people want to connect with you, how do they do it?
Yeah, best place is my website, which is MikeMcAllowitz.com. And, you know, I got a blog. The podcast is up there. The link to Profit First Professionals, a professional organization we built around Profit First, is there. And then if you choose to subscribe, the cool thing I have is I used to write for the Wall Street Journal, and for about 3 years I selected my 10 best performing articles of all time and have republished them and given to my subscribers to the website.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm not sure if I'm signed up for that. I'll have to make sure to do that. So.
Cool, man. Would love to have you.
Sweet.
They can spam the living heck out of
you. That's right. Keep sending it.
I'm kidding. I don't spam. I mean, a little bit. No, I'm kidding.
Maybe once. Okay.
Yeah, maybe once. With French toast.
With French toast and a 12-pack of something. So, so this has been episode 1 of 1 with Mike McAllowitz. And I know you know why I said
that. I know exactly why you said
that's
that.
A running joke on your podcast. So, but listen, this is that's it for this episode of the Strongpreneur Podcast. Take what you heard today. Don't be a moron and actually apply it. Wage your own war on mediocrity in your business so that you can have a strong business that serves you and your life. And don't forget to follow Mike and buy the book Profit First, and check me out as well at motorhard.com. We will see you all next time.
See you later.